Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Voices of Reform series, addressing issues surrounding California governance reform made possible by the generous support of the James Irvine Foundation. I'm Zabre Valentine, Project Director for the Voices of Reform series and your chair for today. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Kim Alexander is the president and founder of the California Voter Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization created in 1994 when Ms. Alexander realized the tremendous potential the internet possessed to strengthen the democratic process here in California and beyond. For the past 10 years, the California Voter Foundation has been providing Californians with nonpartisan election and government information on the web and raising awareness of emerging democracy and technology issues in California and nationally. The scope of the foundation's work has expanded over the years to include advocating for better campaign finance disclosure and modeling new disclosure resources, developing innovative education materials for voters across the country, and studying cutting-edge digital democracy issues such as internet voting and online political communication. The California Voter Foundation's website won the prestigious Webby Award in 1999 and provides a wealth of information about voting technology, California elections, campaign disclosure, and voting privacy. Ms. Alexander's interest in the nexus between democracy and technology led her to become involved specifically with voting technology. And in the last year, she has become one of the nation's leading voices for secure and verifiable computerized voting systems, which will be the subject of her remarks this evening. In 1999, she served on California's Internet Voting Task Force, which in 2000 issued the first comprehensive study of internet voting security. In 2001, Ms. Alexander was named one of the 25 people changing the world of the internet and politics by Harvard University, the American Association of Political Consultants, and Politics Online. In 2003, she served on the California Secretary of State's ad hoc touchscreen voting task force. Finally, just this April, Ms. Alexander received the 2004 Electronic Frontier Foundation Pioneer Award, which was also given to computer scientists David Dill and Avi Rubin to honor their leadership in the popular movement for integrity and transparency in modern elections. Kim Alexander is a 1988 graduate of the University of California, Santa Barbara, with degrees in political science and philosophy. And now, I'm very pleased to welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California, Kim Alexander.
Thank you, Zabre, for that very nice introduction, and thank you to everyone for coming this evening. A friend once remarked to me that reforming voting technology is like trying to turn around the Queen Mary. Some days it feels a lot more like the Titanic, but either way, the good news is that we are headed in a safer direction today than we were just 18 months ago. California's electronic voting debate is representative of the debate that's raging nationwide over this issue. California's political leaders like our Secretary of State and California-based organizations such as the California Voter Foundation, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and computer scientist Dave Dill's Verified Voting are at the forefront of this growing national e-voting reform movement. The progress that is made here in California has an impact far beyond our state's borders. Most recently, just yesterday, there was a landmark ruling by a U.S. federal court judge that supports our Secretary of State's reform efforts. I'm going to get to that a little bit later, but first, I'd like to bring you all up to speed on what the e-voting debate is all about. So prior to 2000, few people ever bothered to look at the mechanics of voting. Elections were something like the sausage factory. People wanted to enjoy the end product without knowing too much about what went into making it. The 2000 presidential election vote counting fiasco in Florida brought a huge dose of sunlight and scrutiny into the nuts and bolts of our voting and vote counting processes. Basically, lots of people started looking under the rock, and we are finding that oversight and the security of our voting systems is miserably inadequate. It's also extremely complex. We have 11,500 election jurisdictions in this country that are inside 50 different states, all with different state laws, all using different voting systems, all with different vendors. It's incredibly complex. The 2000 presidential election also resulted in a huge infusion of federal money into state and local government coffers to fund the acquisition of newer and more modern voting systems. In 2002, Congress enacted the Help America Vote Act, also known as HAVA, which included nearly $4 billion in funding to improve the voting processes and pay for new voting equipment. In California, voters enacted Proposition 41, the Voting Modernization Bond Act. Now, neither of these two acts required local governments to purchase electronic voting systems, but many chose to do so rather than upgrading to paper-based optical scan systems, despite the fact that these systems cost a fraction of what the touchscreens cost. Basically, voting equipment vendors weren't pushing optical scan systems in 2001 and 2002. They were selling touchscreens, and counties in California and other states throughout the country started buying. The problem with electronic voting systems is that they produce results that cannot be verified. After a voter casts a ballot on an electronic touchscreen voting machine, there is no paper record of that ballot that is produced, which the voter can verify to ensure that his ballot was accurately captured by the machine. Not only is the voter unable to verify that his vote was accurately recorded, but the elections department is also unable to verify whether the votes that are counted and reported are the same as those that were recorded. Voting systems must protect against two kinds of risks. First, there are accidental errors that result in giving the race to the wrong candidate. And secondly, there's deliberate vote fraud. With e-voting systems, it's as if we're trying to eliminate fraud and error by eliminating the ability to detect it. That's like trying to solve your accounting problems by eliminating your accounting department. The election officials who've purchased these systems and the vendors that supply them insist that e-voting is secure, and they claim that reformers and computer scientists are overreacting. So, let's take a walk through the life of an electronic ballot and see just how perfectly everything has to work for the final results to be accurate. First, the voter casts a ballot on a computer voting machine, which must correctly record and store that ballot. All the machines are connected together at the end of the voting day, and the ballots are transferred into one machine, where they are stored onto a cartridge. The poll workers then return these cartridges to a vote collection center, where they are downloaded. Next, the electronic ballots are transferred to the central counting center at the county election office, where they are tabulated using vote counting software. Then the tabulated data is used to generate reports of election results. Each of these steps must be glitch-free and perfectly programmed. Each step of the way, every electronic ballot must be protected. If an electronic ballot is lost or altered along the way, it would be difficult to detect and impossible to determine what the correct ballot should be. And even if everything appears to go perfectly, we still end up with results that can't be verified. Computer risks in elections are not a new problem. In fact, this is actually an old problem that's been kicking around ever since we started using software to count punch card ballots. A generation ago in the 1960s, computer experts warned that software could be programmed to defy pre- and post-election testing by being programmed to work differently in test mode than in live mode. In California, we addressed such risks a long time ago when our legislature enacted the manual count law in 1965. This law requires that a subset of paper ballots be selected at random and publicly counted by hand. The hand-counted totals must be shown to match the software-counted totals. If they don't match, you have paper ballots to fall back on to get the vote count right. And in fact, California's manual count process has repeatedly shown software vote counts to be inaccurate. Let me give you some recent examples of paper ballots being miscounted by computer software in California. In Napa County, officials discovered that their Sequoia optical scanners had not been properly calibrated to detect the various types of ink with which the primary ballots were marked. In San Diego, Diebold software awarded nearly 3,000 votes cast on absentee paper ballots for Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry to Dick Gephardt, who by that time had dropped out of the race. And last October, Alameda County discovered that Diebold's optical scan software attributed 9,000 votes to a socialist recall candidate that should have gone to Cruz Bustamante. We know about these miscounts because the counties were able to compare the paper absentee ballots to the software counted results. When the numbers didn't add up, the counties were able to troubleshoot, diagnose, and correct the vote counting problems. Now, absentee ballots typically account for about 25% of a county's total vote. For the remaining 75% of the ballots that were cast on electronic voting machines in those three counties, there is no audit trail that registrars can use to verify the accuracy of the vote count. Officials from Alameda and San Diego and Napa were quick to assure the public that while they experienced vote counting problems with their paper absentee ballots, the vote count for their electronic ballots was accurate. But the truth is, they really can't be sure, and they have no way to prove it, because they have no paper record they can use to verify the accuracy of the software-counted electronic votes. Whether such vote-counting errors are accidental glitches or intentional efforts to tamper with election results is unknown. What we do know is that glitches and errors have and will continue to occur in elections, regardless of what voting system is used. As we saw on March 2nd, computerized voting was a disaster in several large California counties. Thousands of California voters were disenfranchised on March 2nd due to technical problems with computerized voting systems. In Alameda County, problems with Diebold's smart card encoders impacted 25% of the county's polling places, preventing voters from casting ballots on touchscreens during part of the day. In San Diego County, smart card encoders problems impacted 55% of that county's polling places. And in Orange County, thousands of voters were given the wrong electronic ballots. Many were unable to cast votes in contests for which they were eligible, while others were allowed to vote in districts in which they did not reside. While the voting problems in Orange and Alameda and San Diego counties garnered the most attention in the weeks following the election, many other counties that use computerized voting systems also had their share of problems. In San Bernardino County, officials waited for 3 hours for their new Sequoia vote counting computer to process the results before resorting to shutting down the computer and starting over. In San Joaquin County, a public radio reporter who selected a polling place at random to interview voters using the county's new Diebold touchscreen voting system arrived to find voters standing around, unable to vote, because the machine being used to program the smart cards was inoperable. And in Merced County, ES&S equipment that had been delivered to one city had been programmed with the ballots of another. Now, I realize that no voting system is perfect, but some systems are more imperfect than others. Not only do e-voting systems lack a voter-verified paper audit trail, but the software that runs these systems is proprietary. In essence, we have outsourced elections and handed the keys to the kingdom over to a handful of private companies. We've shifted from paper-based systems that rely to a small degree on software that is verified to entirely paperless systems that rely solely on software that cannot be verified. One key reform that has earned widespread endorsement is to implement a requirement that electronic voting machines produce a paper record summarizing the voter's choices that the voter can verify before leaving the polls. This record is not a receipt that the voter keeps. It's a paper backup of that voter's choices, which is collected at polling places and later used to verify the final results and also for recounts. Now, most election officials that have purchased e-voting systems insist the paper trail is not necessary and that government oversight can protect us from e-voting risks. I wish I could believe that. But the truth is that voting system oversight has been a failure at all levels of government. Election officials who defend paperless e-voting systems insist that everything is tested and certified. Unfortunately, this is not true. Last December, the Secretary of State conducted an audit of the 17 California counties using voting systems manufactured by Diebold. The audit found uncertified software or hardware being used in all 17 counties. Three of these counties were using software that had not been federally tested. And in five of the counties, Diebold reported versions of software or hardware that were being used that differed from the ones that were actually found in that county. Now, this matter of counties using software that had never been federally tested, three counties were found in this audit to have used software, including Los Angeles County, that had never been tested. This means that basically no one had looked at it other than Diebold. There is little reason for the public to trust the outcome of elections conducted on paperless, computerized voting systems run on secret software. But there is absolutely no reason to trust election results when the software being used has never been tested or inspected. As Connie McCormick, the Los Angeles County Registrar, told the LA Times last November, "All of us have made changes to our software, even major changes, and none of us have gone back to the Secretary of State. But it was no secret we've been doing this all along." So maybe this has been going on for a long time. With a paper voting system such as optical scan, which uses software to count ballots, at least you have an audit trail for every ballot. So if the software doesn't work properly, you have a way to detect and recover from that problem. So maybe it wasn't such a big deal that systems weren't always certified or that corners were being cut. But those practices become totally unacceptable when you're talking about a paperless e-voting system. With e-voting systems, certification is the last line of defense against error and fraud. Now, we do have federal voting system standards, but they're voluntary. And federal qualification of voting systems has been managed over the past 10 years by a handful of election officials through an organization called NASED, the National Association of State Election Officials, Election Directors, and a Texas-based organization called the Election Center. NASED and the Election Center facilitate the testing and voting equipment by independent testing authorities. In recent months, it's come to light that some of these so-called independent labs make campaign contributions to political parties, and that the vendors contribute money to the organizations that oversee the federal testing process. Some vendors are also politically active. Diebold CEO, for example, Wally O'Dell, wrote a fundraising letter on behalf of President Bush to fellow Ohio Republicans last year, urging them to donate to the president and stating he was committed to delivering Ohio's electoral votes to Bush. This fundraising letter was sent out at a time when Diebold was vying for favored vendor status to sell Ohio thousands of inauditable paperless touchscreen voting machines. The Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, created the expectation that federal dollars spent on new voting systems would pay for systems that would meet the newer 2002 federal voting system standards. The Election Assistance Commission, or EAC, a new federal agency created by HAVA to oversee the standards and disperse federal dollars, only began holding hearings this year and is woefully underfunded. Under HAVA, federal oversight of the voting system standards was supposed to shift from NASA and the Election Center to NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, but that funding has yet to be provided. HAVA created the illusion that the more current 2002 federal standards would be implemented, but they have not. Today, all the voting systems in this country, including systems that are receiving federal funding, have only been qualified to the 1990 federal voting system standards, if at all. The $20 million earmarked in HAVA for research and development into newer, better voting systems has not been provided. In short, HAVA is a broken promise. In May, DeForest Soares, chairman of the EAC, went before a House Appropriations Committee to ask for more funding. During the hearing, Representative John Olver of Massachusetts expressed surprise that the EAC was poised to distribute federal funds to the states without having conducted research on voting system guidelines. Olver asked Soares, "We're going to distribute $2.3 billion to them now, and we haven't done a bit of the research, none of the research that would have helped them make the best possible decision." "That's an accurate description," Soares said. "I don't know what else to say," Olver said. "Welcome to our world," Soares replied. This is a classic example of government putting the cart before the horse. There are 42 states, including California, that claim to follow the federal voting system standards. But as we've seen in recent months, many of our counties have no problem using voting equipment that's not federally qualified. Four California counties, Kern, San Joaquin, Solano, and San Diego, spent $45 million in taxpayer money last year to acquire touchscreen voting equipment that was not federally qualified. After all this country went through in 2000, after millions of Americans watched and waited as courts pored over Florida's sloppy and corrupt election mess, after the counting stopped when our Supreme Court halted it and proclaimed George W. Bush the winner, after the federal, state, and local governments across the country threw hundreds of millions of dollars in to buy new voting machines, it was incredibly disappointing to me to learn that four of our counties took delivery of equipment that was not federally qualified. On April 30th, California Secretary of State Kevin Shelley banned the particular model in question, Diebold's AccuVote TSX machine. In addition, he imposed a moratorium on any new purchases of paperless e-voting systems. Shelley also decertified all other e-voting systems in California, but will allow these systems to be recertified if the counties using them do one of two things. They can either retrofit the machines with the voter-verified paper trail, or they can use them without the paper trail if the counties agree to 23 security requirements. The two most important recertification requirements are, number one, that the vendors provide their software source code to the Secretary of State for review, and number two, that the counties using e-voting systems give voters the option of voting on a paper ballot if they choose to do so. This was not a capricious decision. It came after months of piling evidence that shows how federal, state, and local oversight of voting systems is rickety and inadequate, and after several days of public hearings where hundreds of people spoke, mostly in opposition to paperless e-voting systems. Shelley's decertification orders were hailed by e-voting reformers as a major victory and harshly criticized by several county registrars as burdensome and unnecessary. Four counties, led by Riverside, took the extraordinary step of suing the Secretary of State. Their lawsuit, filed in federal court, known as Benavides versus Shelley, claims that the Secretary of State overstepped his authority when he decertified the touchscreens. A handful of groups advocating on behalf of disabled voters joined in the lawsuit, arguing that Shelley's restrictions on the use of e-voting machines reduced the ability for disabled and sight-impaired voters to cast a secret ballot without assistance. The California Voter Foundation, along with several other groups, filed a friend of the court brief in support of the Secretary of State, urging the judge to dismiss the case. Just yesterday, Judge Florence Marie Cooper issued her ruling. She denied the plaintiff's request for a temporary restraining order to prevent Shelley's decertification orders from taking effect. In her decision, Judge Cooper wrote, "Nothing in the Americans with Disabilities Act or its regulations reflects an intention on the part of Congress to require secret independent voting, and that the interest in the Secretary of State in fulfilling his statutory duties and the public interest in accurate, verifiable vote counts outweigh the plaintiff's interest in an unassisted private vote." Judge Cooper also dismissed the plaintiff's claim that Secretary Shelley overstepped his authority. Her ruling cites several California statutes authorizing the Secretary of State to approve and regulate voting systems and giving the Secretary of State the right to withdraw approval of voting systems if it is deemed by the Secretary to be defective, obsolete, or otherwise unacceptable. In her decision, Judge Cooper said the Secretary is therefore not only authorized but expressly directed to withdraw his approval of any voting system found to be defective or unacceptable. She concluded that the plaintiffs have not demonstrated a likelihood of success on the merits as to any claim in this action. Defendant's decision to decertify touchscreen voting machines and to withhold further certification until he is satisfied that manufacturers and counties have complied with specified conditions is a reasonable one. It is based on studies conducted and information gathered, which convinced him that the public's right to vote is not adequately protected by the systems currently in place. This landmark ruling, which takes into account California's laws as well as federal laws like the ADA and HAVA, will have a reverberating impact on states across the country. This decision also reinforces the leadership our Secretary of State is bringing to this critical issue. This court ruling is a major victory for paper trail proponents and clears a path for the reforms being implemented in California. So you may be wondering, what is standing in the way? Why is there all this resistance to reform? It's possible that the system was set to fail to create an opportunity for fraud, and the idea of a conspiracy is very popular. After all, people spend hundreds of millions of dollars and countless hours attempting to influence the outcome of elections. And let's face it, not everyone in this country is honest. So if you wanted to cheat in an election, eliminating the ability to audit the election would be a good way to be sure you could get away with it. As tempting as these theories are, I think it's more likely that we are where we are with our voting systems because of government atrophy. In the voting equipment business, we find all of the ingredients that make up a typical government debacle. First, we've got regulatory capture. This is what happens when the regulators and the regulated become so closely intertwined that the regulators go exclusively to the regulated for information and ideas. And this may explain why election officials who have purchased e-voting systems are ignoring the concerns of computer scientists. We've got the revolving door, which swings very fast in the voting equipment business. At least five former election officials, including the former California Secretary of State, Bill Jones, have worked for voting equipment vendors. There's conflict of interest. The vendors who recruit former election officials to come work for them do so in order to parlay those former officials' relationships with current election officials in order to win favor and contracts. In addition, we've got local government procurement scandals with counties taking delivery of unqualified equipment, plus the failure of federal and state oversight. All of these conditions have festered due to a vacuum of sunlight. Whenever such conditions are present in any area of government, it's a warning signal that all is not right. The good news is that change is coming. Last month, California Secretary of State introduced paper trail standards, the first in the nation, to guide the development of the voter-verified paper trail. And next door in Nevada, the Secretary of State is implementing touchscreens with a voter-verified paper trail for this November. California's requirement doesn't take effect until 2006. In the meantime, Kevin Shelley's recertification requirements ensure that voters who live in counties that use touchscreens will have the option to cast a paper ballot at the polls, what I call the paper or plastic approach. Now, the voter-verified paper trail is no panacea. That paper record has little value if it isn't used as an audit tool to verify the final results. It must be implemented as part of a suite of reforms. Others include routine verification of results, such as California's manual count law, independent inspection of voting software source code, and fair recount laws. California is one of only two states in the country that routinely verifies the software to use to count paper ballots through a public manual count. West Virginia is the other state. The sobering truth of the matter is that elections in other states could have been given to the wrong person by accident or through fraud over the past several decades, and nothing was ever done about it. People ask, why is it that 4 years after Florida, we still haven't fixed our voting systems? It's because this problem is bigger than anything that can be solved in just one election cycle. It will take years to reform computerized voting and vote counting in the United States. And in the meantime, we have a presidential election in just 4 months. The California Voter Foundation will be urging voters in e-voting counties to vote on paper as we did in March, either by requesting an absentee ballot or requesting a paper ballot at their polling place. Our goal is to minimize the e-voting risks by increasing the percentage of ballots cast on paper. We are also working in coordination with several other organizations to minimize e-voting risks in presidential election battleground states. Activists are educating themselves, making Public Records Act requests, finding out if their local equipment is certified and tested, and monitoring and documenting everything they can. They're attending meetings, they're asking questions. They are Democrats, Republicans, Greens, Libertarians, old, young, rural, urban, online, offline. There is a movement underway in this country for transparent and verifiable voting systems. It is a movement made up of people who refuse to avert their eyes, who are willing to peer inside the sausage factory. I believe we will win because the American people have a good track record of overcoming voting restrictions. But change takes time. The history of this nation has been one long struggle to expand and protect the right to vote. Sure, this is a tough fight, but most things worth fighting for are. Ballots are the bright line between civility and chaos. Ballots are what distinguish free nations from enslaved ones. Ballots are what we use to transact our informed consent. As the U.S. works to foster democracy abroad in Iraq and in Afghanistan, it's more important than ever that we set a good example of how to conduct elections here at home. Those who fight for the paper trail do so out of a fierce love for democracy. Reliable election results, after all, are the heart of legitimate government. A government is only legitimate when it has won the consent of the governed. And that consent can only be won when elections are conducted not in secret, but in plain sight. Thank you.
Our thanks to Kim Alexander, president of the California Voter Foundation, for her comments today. I'm Scott Schaefer, host of the California Report on KQED Public Radio, and I'm going to be moderating today's question and answer period. And we have lots of questions, so there's no shortage of those. Kim, why don't we get started with...
I saw all those questions coming up here.
There's more coming, I think.
Great.
First question is, why is e-voting being pushed on us? With Diebold's inappropriate behavior, why are we still using them?
I mentioned earlier that there's been a lot of marketing of e-voting systems, and it began even before Florida 2000. And basically, after the Florida vote counting fiasco, there was this rush all across the country, and I think the vendors were smart and took advantage of the punch card fiasco in Florida and said, hey, here's a chance to sell new voting systems, and they were pushing touch screens. So you have to go back to this issue, what I raised, of regulatory capture and the fact that the vendors and the election officials who have bought these systems are close, and those relationships influence those purchasing decisions. I want to mention there is one county that did that has abandoned Diebold. Solano County, just across the bay, has decided to dump Diebold altogether and is now using a different vendor, ES&S, and is using an optical scan system.
Kim, what's your sense of why the Diebold AccuVote TSX, which is the machine that was banned by Kevin Shelley, why was that never federally certified, as well as some of the software that was installed? Why did that not happen?
Well, what happened was... And I should mention, I mean, I go to all of the voting system panel meetings, which happen in Sacramento. In fact, there's one next Wednesday. Next Monday, you're all welcome to come. I was at a meeting of the county registrars back in 2002, and I was telling them that I supported the paper trail, which many of them were very upset to hear. And one of them said, you really need to go to these voting system panel meetings. Have you ever been to a certification meeting? I said, no. Well, you have no right to criticize this process until you actually go to these meetings. So I started going to these meetings, the voting system panel meetings, and I go to them now all the time. Every time there's one, I'm there. It used to be me and 12 people. Now there's like 200 people at every meeting and 10 cameras, and it's just a completely different environment. But at one of these meetings back in November, Diebold's representative, as well as one of the Secretary of State's own staff people, told the panel that the TSX was federally qualified. They said it had finished testing at the federal level. So Diebold and a member of the Secretary of State's own staff misinformed the panel that certifies voting systems, and they went ahead and certified the TSX, And then I made a Public Records Act request for that documentation because I wanted to see it, and it couldn't be produced because it didn't exist because it wasn't federally qualified. So that was a little lesson about the value of Public Records Act requests. They can tell you information that the government's supposed to have but doesn't have, in this case, federal qualification letter. At that point, it was January, and it was too late for the Secretary of State to decertify the machine because there's a statutory requirement that no machines are decertified less than 6 months prior to an election. So essentially, the Secretary of State had to wait until after the March primary to decertify that particular unit, which he did on April 30th.
The Secretary of State could have gone further than he did in April. He could have banned all the machines in the 14 counties instead of just the ones in the four counties. Right. He could also have, I suppose, decertified Diebold altogether from selling election equipment in California. In your opinion, did he go far enough?
Well, honestly, we were hoping that he would have gone farther. I mean, we wanted to see a ban on all paperless DRE systems in California this November. But as I said earlier, you know, change takes time, and this is like turning the Queen Mary around. So I think that Kevin Shelley made the best decision that he could make given the situation that he faces. I mean, you've got counties, even with the decision that he made, which I thought was incredibly reasonable, he still ended up having four counties sue him over it. So I think that I have confidence that he is going to make sure that those 23 security requirements that I mentioned earlier are going to fulfill the needs that we have, but we all need to be vigilant as well. I mean, even if you're not in an e-voting county, as I mentioned earlier, voting systems are incredibly complex, and there are so many different models out there, and there's a lot of value in one person getting to know their local system really well because their local system is different than the one right next door. So asking those questions, finding out who your vendor is, finding out what model it is, asking to look at those procedures that are supposed to guide this, all of that can really help make sure that in all of our counties, our voting transactions are happening safely.
Here's an interesting question from somebody. Why should we be worried about inaccurate counting when there is no security on who votes under which name at the polling place? Do we need more security at the polling place?
That's a good question. You know, I hear from a lot of voters who are concerned that you don't have to show ID at the polls. And it's funny, I had been thinking, well, you know, I think that there's a compromise there about ID that you could show a utility bill or something like that. And then I had a phone call from a reporter in South Dakota who was telling me about some of these some election fraud issues on Indian reservations in South Dakota, where they have an ID requirement, and there were Native Americans who were being turned away because they didn't have an ID, they didn't have a driver's license, they don't have a utility bill. And I think that there's this, you know, it's very easy for the folks in this room to think, of course everybody has an ID, everybody has a utility bill, but there are a lot of people who are entitled to vote that don't have those things. Now, when you sign in to vote, and this is the thing, the idea of voting at a local polling place, that's part of the security. It's this quaint idea that if you go to your local polling place, that it's your neighbor who's working there, and that they know you, and you know them, and that's where some of the security ideas came from. We don't live in that world anymore. Some of us have polling places like that, but a lot of people are moving around, and so I do think we really need to rethink the security requirements. I'm not sure that showing an ID is the best way. It might be that a good way to deal with this is to make sure that when people sign the poll book, they're told you're signing under penalty of perjury. I mean, that's the law, but people don't realize that. And maybe if every time we signed in, we were told that, it would give voters that are worried about the security issue a little bit more peace of mind.
You said that the current security measures are sort of quaint and they're sort of rooted in a time gone by. And I'm wondering, to what extent do you think we need to really overhaul everything we do about elections and the way in which we ask people to vote? For example, wouldn't it make sense to, if you want to increase voter turnout, to allow people to vote, make it possible that they vote in shopping malls, supermarkets, banks, and places where people go so they don't have to make an extra trip in order to do something they seem somewhat disinclined to do?
Right. Well, you know, there's a lot of desire to make voting more convenient. And there have been efforts to do that. We have absentee voting. You can be a permanent absentee voter. You can register now 15 days prior to the election instead of 29. You can, if you're not registered at your current address, you can go to your county elections office and vote on election day. So we've made a lot of accommodations to make voting more accessible and convenient for people. I do think, though, fundamentally, that we have a 19th century voting system. I mean, it's highly decentralized, very inefficient. It's dependent on people who are essentially volunteers, who get very little training. You know, poll workers are really the last line of defense when it comes to security. And God bless them, they work hard. They don't earn hardly anything. They're working 16-hour days. It's a very thankless job in a lot of ways to be a poll worker. I'm sure there's a few poll workers here in this room. I see some people nodding their heads. So it is a thankless job, and the system is going to break because of that. I mean, we need to have something more advanced than that, especially if we're going to use high-tech equipment. And so the idea I've been floating for quite a while now, and I think it's getting some traction, is to establish high-tech voting centers. You know, keep the neighborhood polling places, but only have paper ballots in our neighborhood polling places, and also set up high-tech voting centers in public places like shopping malls, or I'd prefer to see them in community centers and libraries and places like that. Bring people in, let them vote starting the weekend prior to the election all the way through to election day. If you have a high-tech voting center, you can staff it with people who are well-trained, you can use all this high-tech equipment, and you can produce that voter-verified paper trail that we so desperately need. I think that's the way that we're going to move. I mean, I know that our Secretary of State has a vision of allowing people to vote anywhere in the state, and we have the technology to do that. But making that happen is going to require some cooperation from the county registrars. And I think that we need to maintain both, that we need to continue to have both our local neighborhood polling places that people can walk to and vote on election day, but also give our highly mobile, more transient population the ability to vote in other locations that might be more convenient for them and locations that can ensure that all this high-tech equipment is being operated in a place that's well-lit, that has ample electricity, that's handicap accessible, and that's staffed by people who can operate the equipment securely.
Most of these decisions about election equipment, which systems to buy and when, and how to install them and how to deal with the software, most of them were made by local election officials, by registrars of voters. And that raises the question of what are the qualifications to be a registrar, a voter, in a county, and do we need to change those qualifications?
That's a really good question, Scott. And, you know, we have 58 counties. And one thing I really want to make sure I get across here is I don't want to paint all registrars with a broad brush. There are a lot of really fabulous people who are working at the county level on elections in this state and all across the country. And it's a very difficult job. It's made more and more complex every year by the legislature and the voters, for that matter, piling more and more requirements and changing our voting systems. We've gone through a lot of changes with term limits and changing the primary around. So it's not an easy job. There are some registrars in the state that have been doing this job for a long time, have a lot of experience. We've lost a lot of our most senior registrars recently, people like Ernie Hawkins in Sacramento County retired recently. And there are really no qualifications for being a registrar. You don't have to get certified. You don't have to go to any special training program. In fact, this election center I was telling you about earlier is having a training institute this summer in Washington, and I just saw the agenda for it. And it's a training program for election officials, and the graduation ceremony for the training program is sponsored by ES&S, one of the vendors. So, you know, that's not what we need. We need different kind. We need real training centers. There is one at American University. There may be one starting up here in California soon, I hope. But a lot of the registrars are people who came up through the ranks of county government. Many of them started out as secretaries and have moved their way up the county government chain. So it's definitely a concern. And some of the registrars, you know, that I have to deal with in public hearings, they do not take well to the criticism. They don't want to hear it. And it's very challenging. I'm really grateful that Kevin Shelley prevailed in this lawsuit because, you know, in those four counties, which were led by by Riverside County. Those four counties sued the Secretary of State. I mean, I couldn't think of anything that undermined voter confidence more than counties questioning the Secretary of State's authority. So hopefully that's been put to an end.
You mentioned that lawsuit that was dismissed this mm-hmm. week by the judge in Los Angeles. And there's a question here about some of the issues that were raised in that lawsuit. And the question is, the e-voting debate increasingly divides groups claiming rights, those arguing for the right to have votes counted in a secure and verifiable way, and those arguing for the voting rights of the disabled and others whom traditional voting technologies have failed. So the question is, how do we reconcile the competing demands of accountability and accessibility?
Well, let me make one clarification. The lawsuit was not dismissed. The request for a temporary restraining order was denied. So the lawsuit is still out there, but it's just going to move at a slower pace than what the plaintiffs might have liked. I think that this debate over security versus accessibility is really unfortunate because it sets up a false choice. The fact is that we can and should have voting systems that are both accessible and secure. And I think disability rights groups that are pushing paperless e-voting systems, when we know from the Johns Hopkins security report and the Robber report and many other reports that have been done, that these systems are not secure. We know this. To continue to push jurisdictions and sue jurisdictions to buy this equipment when it's been so widely revealed that it is riddled with security problems is a disservice to their constituency. I believe anybody who votes wants their vote to count. Why else would you be showing up at the polls? I don't care if you're blind or you're disabled or you're young or old, whoever you are, if you're going to vote, you want your vote to count and you want the elections department to be able to verify your vote. So what the California Voter Foundation and EFF and lots of other groups that are working on the paper trail have been doing is making sure that we develop a paper trail that is accessible, that a blind voter can verify the information that's printed out on that record. We have the technology to do this. And the Help America Vote Act sets the deadline for providing at least one device that allows a disabled voter to cast a secret ballot without assistance by 2006. What happened was some disability rights groups jumped the gun on that deadline. All of the paper trail proponents have been operating under this expectation that we would have until 2006 to get the paper trail innovated and developed and out into the marketplace. Suddenly, particular disability rights groups, the American Association of People with Disabilities, started suing to push counties, to pressure counties to buy touchscreens sooner rather than later, before the paper trail was ready. And fortunately, this federal judge said, there's nothing in the ADA that says you have to have a secret independent ballot, and the Help America Vote Act deadline is 2006. So we have till 2006 to have an accessible voter-verified paper trail. And fortunately, our Secretary of State and his new paper trail standards articulate how that accessible voter-verified paper trail will work.
I want to remind everyone that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker tonight is Kim Alexander, president of the California Voter Foundation, and she's discussing the implementation of technology in the voting process. That issue of verifiable paper trails. Mm-hmm. To what extent has the federal government addressed that issue and tried to come up with some sort of a national standard?
You know, there have been so many bills, well, at least a couple of bills, in Congress and in California that keep writing in some sort of paper trail requirement, and somehow people keep skating around it. It's really frustrating, but there was a paper trail requirement in the Help America Vote Act, and it's been redefined to mean something other than what the authors originally wanted it to mean. Same thing with Proposition 41. There was a paper trail requirement in it, and it was redefined by the Voting Modernization Board. So there have been several legislative attempts to require a paper trail, and people keep skirting around them. There are several bills pending in Congress right now to require a voter-verified paper trail. One of them is Rush Holt's HR 2239. That was the first one. That's the bill that's got the most support. And there's a big day of action on July 13th that you might check around in your community and see what's going on to support that bill and other efforts in Congress to require the paper trail.
I just want to acknowledge that our Secretary of State, Kevin Shelley, has snuck in and walked in and is sitting in the back, and I'm sure he would be happy to take some questions afterwards if you'd like to talk with him. Kim, this idea of standards, we have 58 counties in California. We have 58 at least systems, and I don't mean different technology, but there are different ways in which the counties go about running their elections,
right,
overseen by the Secretary of State. Do you think we need more standardization, or should we continue to leave pretty important decisions up to the local officials?
I do think that we need more standardization. When the Help America Vote Act was passed by Congress, it was with this idea that local officials make the best decisions about what their voters need. And given the purchasing decisions that we've seen, at least here in California, I don't think I agree with that anymore. So what I would say is that we do need some standardization. I do think that the Secretary of State will bring us that. There's a commitment on the part of the Secretary of State's office to make all the procedures available online, to make all that information more transparent so people can do a better job of following that. I'll give you an example of the differences. In Alameda County, at the end of the election, at the polling place workers print out a paper audit trail that summarizes all the votes cast on a touchscreen. Now, it's not a voter-verified paper trail, but it is a paper audit trail, and it's useful. Well, down in Riverside County, they don't produce that paper audit trail, even though the equipment that they bought was originally certified by the Secretary of State to produce that paper audit trail. For some reason, Riverside County took delivery of 4,250 machines that don't have the ability to produce this paper audit trail. There was a candidate in Riverside County, Linda Subaru, who ran against an incumbent for the Board of Supervisors, Bob Buster. She missed a runoff by 45 votes. She could not have access to that paper audit trail that a candidate in Alameda would have had access to because her county registrar and supervisors don't produce that paper audit trail. And when she asked for access to the redundant memory that was stored inside those touchscreens to see if the data inside the touchscreens matched the final vote results, she was denied that access. In fact, the county hired lawyers to write her letters saying, you can't have this access.
Why not?
They said it wasn't relevant. I mean, this is what they said. It's not relevant. So this candidate is now considering a lawsuit. I mean, she doesn't hold out any hope of getting back on the ballot. She missed that contest window. But she's concerned, as I am, and lots of people are, that counties are making up these rules and that there isn't consistency. And that redundant memory that's in those touchscreens in Riverside that this candidate can't have access to is one of the benefits of touchscreens that Michelle Townsend, the Registrar of Voters in Riverside, has gone around the country telling people about and why touchscreens are so great and so reliable. So fortunately, with the recertification requirements that the Secretary of State has come out with, all of the counties will have to produce that manual audit trail. All of the counties that use e-voting systems will have to post the results of those manual audit trail, those paper audit trails outside the polling places. So we will get some standardization for November.
We're here, of course, in San Francisco County, which does not have a perfect record when it comes to running elections, although the last few have been pretty good. To what extent do we just have to accept the fact that elections are not perfect mechanisms and that there are going to be problems? And in a sense, we have to choose the kinds of problems we're willing to tolerate.
I said earlier, no voting system is perfect. And, running an election is a lot more than just the equipment. You have to make sure that all of the procedures are being followed, and it's very complex. I think that if there were standardization, we would have better security, because it's very difficult to track what's happening in all the different jurisdictions when it varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But San Francisco is lucky in that they do have a state-of-the-art optical scan voting system with precinct count scanners. And so San Francisco hasn't bought touchscreens. I really hope San Francisco doesn't buy touchscreens, or if they do, just buy some of them to meet the disability access requirement by 2006. San Francisco also has instant runoff voting in the works, so that makes it a more interesting issue here. But at least San Francisco voters can sleep well at night knowing that they're not going to have the kinds of e-voting problems that voters in other counties have had.
And that instant runoff system, I think, begins this November, if I'm not mistaken. How does this issue of the technology, how is it complicated by instant runoffs?
Well, with instant runoff, you're running the ballots through another layer of software, so it's another level of checking that you have to do. So I think it's really important that San Francisco, as it moves into instant runoff voting, make sure that that manual count law that I've spent so much time talking about this evening is extended to include the instant runoff voting ballots and to make sure that the ranked choices work properly.
The sort of black hat company in all this has been Diebold Election Systems, which I believe is based in Ohio. And there's a question here that says, in the example of Diebold, you mentioned that the CEO, was that wasn't the Secretary of State, was it? You mentioned that the CEO supported President Bush. Are you implying that his company's software will be biased in favor of Republicans?
That's a good question. No, I'm not implying that. I brought it up because elections are not just about security in fact, but also security in perception. And when you have that kind of conflict where the CEO of a voting company is clearly engaged in partisan activities and is at the same time engaged in selling inauditable voting systems, whether the two facts have anything to do with each other, it creates a perception of a conflict.
We've got just a few minutes left. One of the most popular movies these days is Fahrenheit 9/11, the documentary by Michael Moore. And I'm wondering, I don't know if you've seen it,
but
it begins with sort of a recounting, if you will, of what happened in Florida in 2000. And I'm just wondering how you feel that movie and sort of the climate we're in, how does it affect people's confidence in the system and their likelihood of voting? Does it make them more likely to vote or less likely?
Well, I'll tell you, the one worry that keeps me up at night is that in the process of exposing all the weaknesses of our voting system, are we going to inadvertently discourage people from voting? And that's, of course, the last thing that I want to do. But I don't think that the right approach is to stick your head under the sand and pretend like everything's okay when it's not. I see this time that we're in right now, these 4 months leading up to November, as a once-in-a-generation opportunity to not only expose the weaknesses, but get them addressed, get the commitments made from politicians that we need to make sure that we resolve this problem for the long run. And as I said earlier, you know, this is a big problem that's been developing over decades, and it's not going to be solved in one election cycle. So I really believe, you know, the American people are resilient, and people are not just going to roll over on this. I mean, people care about voting. And I think about the 100 million people in this country that voted in the last election. 100 million people. They all wanted their vote to count. And I don't think that they're not going to come back just because they're worried about e-voting. I think they're going to come back even stronger. I hope they will. And my group and lots of other groups I know will be encouraging people not only to monitor and keep track of their local voting process, but to engage in that process and to volunteer as poll workers, and most importantly, to vote, because you can't criticize your local election process if you're not a voter. The best way to inform yourself is to be a voter and participate in the process, and through that experience, we will all become much better informed and better equipped to resolve these challenges.
Kim, at the very beginning when you were introduced, it was noted that you got involved and with the California Voter Foundation because you saw this great potential for the internet in our elections, in our electoral process. And I'm just wondering, in those 10 years that have gone by, how have your perceptions and your ideas of the role of the internet in our elections, how have they changed?
Well, in the early years, it was much more about opportunities to make democracy better through technology. And in the latter years, it's been a lot more about trying to make sure that technology doesn't harm democracy. So it's more challenging and maybe not quite as much fun as it was when we were, you know, building online voter guides and writing the proposition song and, you know, doing some of these more creative and fun projects. Now we're tackling things like e-voting and voter privacy, which is a very big and worrisome issue. But I think that, you know, I love doing this work because I recognize that California is a trendsetter. We're a bellwether state. What happens here in democracy and in our politics has an impact across the nation and, in fact, across the world. So my strategy all along has been to make sure that we can innovate good digital democracy practices here in California so that we can make sure that our voters are well served and at the same time set a good example for the rest of the nation to follow. And I'm happy to tell you that that strategy has worked over and over again. It worked on our promoting internet disclosure of money in politics. California was one of the first states to do that. Now it's happening all over the country. We slowed down the internet voting train that came out of California. People thought we wouldn't be able to turn that around, and we did. We were one of the first organizations and first states to have voter information on the internet. Now it's everywhere. So I believe that we'll see that again with e-voting, and it's going to take some time, like I said, but I think that we are in good hands with our Secretary of State, and he's taking us down a path that will lead not only California to reform of our voting systems and more voter confidence, but will also set an example for the rest of the country to follow.
And I'm going to set an example and wrap this up on time. Our Great. Thanks to Kim Alexander, President of the California Voter Foundation, for her comments here tonight. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned. Thanks.